This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars Episode 97 was recorded on March 16th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast when it comes to quant and rules-based investing. I'll tell you how to claim a free copy of their new guide to the best investing books ever written at the end of this episode. Joining us now is the one and only Jeff Snyder, CIO at Alhambra Partners. Jeff, needless to say, we are speaking, recording this just after the open on Monday morning, and things are breaking down. We've got, at one point, S&P futures on the June contract traded as low as 23.49. So, needless to say, things are falling apart. When we last spoke at the end of February, you said the economy and financial system were already in a fragile state. Well, I guess that proved prescient, didn't it? I've been saying since before that, going back 6 weeks now, that the COVID-19 coronavirus outbreak was the biggest mispricing of risk in the history of financial markets. So together, we agreed that if these things came together, you better watch out. Well, needless to say, you better watch out. These things are self-reinforcing, and I think there's an oversized potential for a downward spiral to continue from here. So, Jeff, in the 3 weeks that have elapsed since your last appearance with me, I think that pretty much sums it up. What we've got on our hands is a good old-fashioned, honest-to-goodness meltdown. And, of course, it wouldn't be a meltdown without a Jeff Snyder chart book, which you've prepared for our listeners. Thanks so much for doing this. I know you've got a lot of obligations to your clients at Alhambra Partners in the middle of this crisis, so we really appreciate that. Listeners, you'll find the download link in the description of this podcast on our homepage at macrovoices.com next to Jeff's picture. Jeff, where do we take it from here?
Well, Eric, you know, as you're saying, you know, we could only push things so far before it's too far. You know, the whole system was weakened by a couple of years, this dollar shortage, you know, and that had pushed the global economy into a pretty serious downturn ever before we got to COVID-19. So any chance that it would end mildly or even with a, you know, something of a decent setback, you know, that all ended with the arrival of the pandemic. And this current crisis has clearly shown that the Federal Reserve does not understand the fundamentals of the modern monetary and financial system. For all the escalating balance sheet operations and emergency rate cuts, we see signs of obviously extreme illiquidity across all sorts of asset classes, whether it's oil, credit, rates, and even gold. You know, the treatment is not correcting the underlying illness, and now markets are left to sort out only bad scenarios. What's the real downside here? Is there anything that can be done about it?
Well, Jeff, I think that brings up a really important point. Many people are wondering, where is the Fed and what happened to all that QE, not QE intervention? I think, to my mind, one of the most important moments in financial history was the futures open on Sunday night, because what happened was we saw on Sunday the biggest emergency intervention, as far as I know, in the history of central banking. You know, they did this huge bazooka shot, and markets still ended up trading limit down on the futures open within minutes after opening. So all of a sudden, I think a lot of people are questioning, you know, and the way I put it in a tweet that I put out is, okay, looks to me like the so-called Fed put just expired. Is that what's going on here?
Well, you know, Eric, you and I have talked about this for years. I often refer people to the one slide we both created for the presentation we made at Harvard Business School last year. It's slide number 3. And it said, first and foremost, central banks just aren't central. They aren't. They tell you all the time that they are with their QEs and repo operator and all this other stuff. But in practice, time and again, you can directly observe the fact that they are outside of the effective monetary system. Go back to last September's big repo rumble. As I said at the time, that was merely a dress rehearsal. It was a quirk, the product of several factors that on their own shouldn't have amounted to all that much. But because of this underlying global dollar shortage, which is predicated first and foremost on money dealers being risk averse, and money dealers are what is actually central in the system, you know, September turned into a fiasco. At the smallest little sign of something abnormal, dealers just pulled themselves out of the situation and sat on the sidelines, no matter how high the repo rate or the federal funds rate skyrocketed. So instead of realizing this risk aversion for what it was, you know, a warning about what could happen when things got real, the Fed did the same thing the Fed always does. They raised the level of bank reserves without ever stopping to figure out for sure that the level of bank reserves was the problem. It wasn't. So September's repo event was a dress rehearsal for what we just saw and what we are still seeing unfolding today. Despite the fact that it was all laid out in advance, Jay Powell predictably blew it. Money dealers over the last 2 weeks, no matter what the Fed has done, they're obviously sitting on the sidelines.
Jeff, you're going to have your work cut out for you if you're going to connect this latest meltdown with last September's repo market trouble. It was quite obvious that there was a problem in the repo market 6 months ago, but it isn't readily apparent that it's the same today.
Yeah, one key reason why is that what happened last year was never really explained. Even in the large volume of academic literature that sprang up about the event and its aftermath, you know, there were many theories that were put forward in all of these papers, but yet all of these papers all ended up basically saying that something else had to be responsible than the thing that they had been raising. So, you know, in very general terms, all we're talking about here is currency elasticity, which is an ages-old concept. The modern monetary system might not be recognizable to the scholars and thinkers who first developed the notion back in the 19th century, but no matter the complex form currency has taken in our modern system, it is still the same basic principle. Now, most people have probably heard of Walter Badgett and his famous central bank dictum, you know, lend freely at high rates on good collateral. This is why he's been called the father of central banking. The notion that when things turn ugly and money dealers in the money market sit on the sidelines, the central bank steps in and offers what is needed. The point being that there isn't a sound money reason for letting a bad situation become much worse, like we're seeing now. Now, Badgett began his argument, if you see on slide 4, by describing the situation first from the perspective of the bank before getting to a central bank. He called it discredit, which is the situation we're actually in right now. You know, a sound bank was one that had built up its reserves in good times to have them ready in bad times. All it needed to do when facing illiquidity or a prospective bank run was to deploy those reserves. As you can see on slide 5, like the movie Jerry Maguire, show me the money. Badgett was being very Socratic in his line of reasoning. You know, an effective response by an individual bank for that individual bank's individual situation, the same would go for a central bank in its systemic purposes. Show the system some money when the demand for money was way up and the private supply was way down. That's the central bank mandate, central mandate of currency elasticity.
Jeff, that's how all of this stuff is supposed to work in theory. And it seems to me like the Fed has made its attempts to do this, but based on the past week, it doesn't look to me like theory is holding up in practice. If you look at what's happened, despite the Fed's actions, it doesn't seem like the Fed knows how to solve this problem. And I would take it a step farther, actually. I would say that it appears to me that the Fed, by signaling that they're obviously panicking, is making things much worse. If you look at what happened in the market today, I think we would have seen this move down in asset markets at the open without any Fed intervention, emergency intervention on Sunday. But it looks to me like the Fed emergency intervention just made it worse.
Yeah, Eric, you know, what we're seeing right now is what happens when the money supply becomes inelastic. Rather than function properly, the financial system breaks down. What is normally an efficient, smooth-running financial system quickly becomes an every-man-for-himself kind of situation. You know, banks and other financial agents hoard not just money, but the most liquid assets. Leverage players lose their basis. Essentially, asset markets turn into almost bidless fire sales. You know, the worst part about it is the real economy suffers a great deal for it. You know, that's why a central bank's central purpose is currency elasticity. You know, forget all that stuff about the other mandates, you know, full employment and inflation. Before either of those, actually, you know, these other mandates follow from that first one, currency elasticity. Taking the actions that are necessary to make sure liquidity is available where it's needed. And with that in mind, let's review Jay Powell's last few months, starting on, you know, with slide six here. You know, if we look at the repo operations, which, you know, which are repo operations that don't actually have anything directly to do with the repo market, you know, these are just transactions that mimic a repo transaction. And at the end of the mimicking, the primary dealer that's involved in the transaction ends up with bank reserves that the Fed only hopes will then be repurposed by that primary dealer in other money markets, repo being one of them. Now, the general idea is that when liquidity becomes too tight out there in these money markets, not just in repo, these primary dealers know that they can go to the Fed and bid on these bank reserves. If the spreads in those money markets are high enough because of this lack of liquidity out there, by obtaining these excess reserves, the dealers then feed them back into the market and clear up the imbalance. Now, that's the theory. In practice, what we see is that on March 3rd, dealers suddenly bid in excess for what was being offered in overnight operations. Now, the cutoff back then was $100 billion, but there was bids submitted for $108 billion.
And March 3rd was also the date of the Fed's emergency 50 basis point rate cut.
Yeah, absolutely. And you start to get a sense of where things stood back then. You know, Jay Powell started that particular day already on the edge, you know, with that surge in dealer bidding for overnight funds at his repo operations, which probably clinched the FOMC's decision for the rate cut. So something had changed on March 2nd. But we already knew that, you know, and we could tell from other from the other form of the Fed's repo operations, the term or 14-day operations, which you can see on slide 7, all the way back on February 4th. There had been a substantial change in bids for term funding from the Fed. Now, the Fed, of course, wasn't supplying all that was being demanded because, like a true bureaucracy, Jay Powell had been saying that, oh, no, everything's fine. We'd fixed everything with our not QE. And therefore, as February began, he was anxious to wind down these repo operations. Just as things were getting serious, which is just what the dealers were telling him by these higher bids, the Fed was actually convinced of the opposite. They don't seem to ever be able to properly read the situation.
Okay, now let's just back up, Jeff, because I really want to make sure that our listeners understand the full gravity of what you're saying. Beginning on February 4th, the dealers began to submit higher bids for term funding in the form of excess reserves. In other words, they're willing to pay more in order to get access to funding from the Fed because things are getting tight. They need the money. The Fed ignored those higher bids and started to actually reduce rather than increase the amount that it would auction each time. And then on March 4th, suddenly dealer bids surged in overnight funding, which was the same day that the FOMC voted for its 50 basis point emergency cut. So it's almost like the market's giving a very clear signal to the Fed. They ignore it and they wait until they get the panic signal, which is the overnight surge in these bids. And then they react in their own form of panic with a 50 basis point rate cut. So to play devil's advocate, Jeff, isn't that how it was supposed to work? Apart from the lower ceiling on the term repos, the overnight repo was the bigger piece of it. It offered up to $100 billion and then more last week.
Yeah, you know, that's just the appearance of money dealing. And we can at least say the jump in dealer bids for repo operations was an increase in the demand for funding. Now, keep in mind these key dates from the Fed's repo operations, February 4th and then March 3rd. Now, let's see what various markets were doing at these same times. Let's begin with the oil market of all places. You go to slide 8, the WTI futures curve. Oil futures are a key indication for us because they are the intersection of finance and the real economy. We've got supply and demand factors in the movement of a real world commodity, but also included in the curve is dollar funding. There's leverage for both suppliers as well as buyers. So going back to the beginning of this year, as you see on slide 8, you know, the WTI curve had been in backwardation. And then while it sold off modestly, it started to be transformed into front end contango.
Okay, Jeff, let me jump in again and make sure that our listeners are on the same page with you. That front month contango is where suppliers or physical owners begin to discount their current prices so that crude begins to move into storage. The lower the front end price is, the more that encourages investors rather than end users to buy up that crude for immediate delivery because it's being sold at a discount and it's encouraging people to buy it and store it so they can sell it at a higher price later on. And that difference between spot and higher futures price, which we call contango, is effectively the price tag for that storage. It's giving those buyers the profits to take some of the oil out of the market, put it in storage and sell it back into the market later on.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's not just perceived supply or demand for oil. There are financial factors, liquidity risks that get traded into that curve because that's a leveraged process from the front to the back. So by February 5th, when the money dealers started bidding up for the Fed's term repo, the WTI curve was already, was modestly in contango at the front end. If you go to slide 9, between February 5th and February 20, there was a small rally in oil, but the curve never changed its shape. And then go to slide 10, the big downdraft. By March 3rd, the WTI curve had already been transformed again, this time into contango the whole way, front to back. That was a crucial indication that something had changed again. And for the worse, before the primary dealers were showing up at the Fed for overnight repos, the oil market was warning that liquidity was disappearing. Massive discounting, front to back, a financial dislocation was showing up on the oil curve before the dealers showed up at the Fed. If you go to slide 11, I had written on February 27th that something in the oil market had just snapped. And then what followed over the next couple of weeks was a pretty epic oil crash. In other words, what followed, especially after March 3rd, was it currency elasticity? Did those bank reserves from the Fed's repo operations end up getting out into the marketplace? It sure didn't seem like it from the oil market's perspective. The more dealers bid for funds from the Fed, the worse it was becoming in at least this one essential asset market.
Well, Jeff, as you know, I spent most of my time studying the crude oil term structure, that curve that you're talking about. And I really think that what happened there is, in the round one of coronavirus scare, everybody thought it was a sudden stop in China. It was isolated to China. And they're saying, okay, there's going to be an immediate collapse in demand. It's going to last for a couple of months. It's going to be over. And there's no reason for those longer dated futures contracts to trade any lower. Needless to say, they got that call completely wrong. When we got to phase two, and finally, even though the evidence frankly should have been obvious for a month, when the market finally woke up to the fact that the rest of the world is going to go through what China went through and that it's just starting for the West, all of a sudden it was a completely different pricing phenomenon. It wasn't the front month selling off in a panic. You actually saw at the very front of the curve, there was a flattening because it was the back of the curve pushing the prices down. But it wasn't just oil, Jeff, because although the crude crash is where it might have started, and I think, as you said, it's because crude oil is more closely connected to the real economy as opposed to the financial economy. Eventually, even stock traders finally woke up, and we saw that the crude crash was followed by the same thing in stocks and other risky asset markets.
Yeah, and we can observe the same changes in behavior in those other markets too. The most basic of them might be U.S. Treasuries. So let's do the same review from the perspective of the yield curve. Starting on slide 12, from the beginning of 2020 to the first bump in repo bids around February 5th, the yield curve, like the WTI curve, sends a modest warning. In this case, inversion in the same spots on the curve where inversion had first showed up in late 2018. Slide 13, unlike oil though, between February 5th and February 20th, the yield curve didn't rally, meaning it didn't steepen and even back out. It kept sagging, if only a little bit more. And if you go to slide 14, then between February 20th and March 3rd, that's when the yield curve really started to collapse. We call it flight to safety, flight to liquidity, whatever. I'll add that it was also a flight to pristine collateral. And it was already in progress by March 3rd. So as we noted from the WTI curve going full contango in late February, something really did snap across the entire system. So more to the point, as these money dealers' bids filled up at the Fed's repo operations, again, did it get better or did it get worse? Clearly the latter. The situation has grown much, much worse. Therefore, we have to ask, what did the Fed's repo operations really tell us? Not that the Fed was being effective at currency elasticity, quite the contrary. The more that was being bid from them, the worse it was becoming in the rest of the global financial system. The repo operations were only an indication of how bad it was getting out there in the monetary system. They were not in any way a means to have dealt with that situation.
Okay, Jeff, looking ahead, what you're saying also includes markets for safe assets too, right? I mean, maybe one of the more puzzling aspects of trading last week was how the stock market got hammered, and yet bonds, at least longer maturity treasuries, they sold off too, which is kind of the opposite of what you would expect when the stock market's selling off.
Yeah, if you go to slide 15, Eric, you're absolutely right. And it did seem to be a puzzle, except this is another indication of how we knew it was among the worst possible liquidity conditions across the entire global system. Not only did the S&P 500 have its worst day since 1987 on Thursday, the same day, you know, there were record declines across European stock markets. Treasuries, at least at the long end, were caught up in the selling too. You know, but during the most extreme cases of currency inelasticity, which means global illiquidity, the farther end of the yield curve usually tends up getting liquidated as well. It's a pretty clear monetary crisis signal. It's a, you know, they call it a high degree of cross-asset correlation. And so, you know, if we're talking about the most extreme cases, then immediately we're going to be looking to 2008 for comparisons, because that's pretty much the only reference we have. And sure enough, if you go to slide 16, during the absolute worst part of the global financial crisis, which was the middle of September 2008 when Lehman and AIG happened, to the middle of October 2008, you know, the S&P 500 tanked by a, you know, an eerie similar 30%. And look what happened to Treasury bonds at the same time. The 10-year Treasury yield backed up from around 3.4% to a high of around 4.1% during the worst global panic in four generations. Almost everything sold off, just some more than others. You know, that it's a huge indication of just how bad the global dollar shortage has gotten last week. And we're getting, you know, obviously, as you said, we're getting the same things this week. When Treasury coupons get caught up in the downdraft, you know with near certainty the liquidity state of the world. If the closest comparison is September and October 2008, what are we really talking about here?
Jeff, it wasn't the whole Treasury yield curve that got caught up in the selling. I know it's an important point for you as it relates to the repo market. Now, you've said before many times how Treasury bills are the most pristine of pristine repo collateral. They were not sold last week. In fact, at times, the buying was quite extreme. So what does that tell us?
Yeah, Eric, and it makes it for another 2008 comparison. If you go to slide 17 again, you know, before Lehman, the week the GSEs were taken into conservatorship, bill rates plunged, along with repo rates and Fed funds. You know, money rates were floored. So in this context, you know, we'll focus just on the bill rates as it relates to collateral in the repo market. And you'll see why, beginning with slide 18. Going back to February 20th of this year, there's that date again. First, the three-month bill yield and then the four-week bill yield precipitate the yield curve collapse. You know, financial agents began piling into T-bills extreme levels, and not because of the rate cuts expected and realized. If you go to slides 19 and 20, it was largely because risk credit pricing was increasingly illiquid. I've said for the last 2 years, you know, we've talked about this a lot too, the collateral side of repo is where the problem's really located, not the bank reserves. To be brief, you know, way too much crap collateral had been allowed to enter the system, you know, junk bonds, CLOs, emerging market corporate euro bonds, those sorts of high credit risks. And dealers knew it. They knew it the whole time. And knowing that can only have made them risk averse, placing them firmly on the sidelines when the system needs them to go Jerry Maguire on everything. So crap collateral becomes illiquid, as you can see in the spreads here on slide 19 and 20, and that herds participants into the pristine forms of collateral, especially T-bills. So whereas in 2008 it was subprime mortgages and even some prime mortgage bonds, this time it's corporate credits freezing up collateral streams, and therefore that sucks liquidity out of the whole damn system.
Jeff, your repo collateral case, it seems to me, also extends to gold. That was another apparent contradiction during last week's meltdown. Gold is normally a hedge against the worst case. So you would expect gold to be up, or I didn't expect it. I actually predicted, as our listeners know, on the Thursday night podcast that gold would go down. But the sharp drop in gold caught a lot of people by surprise, even if not Macro Voices listeners. So I want to remind listeners that Jeff and I discussed the links between gold and repo collateral a few years ago. And that interview that we did about gold and repo collateral and the intersection between them is every bit as relevant today as it was the day it was recorded. So we're going to put the link to that, just to make it easy for you to find it, in the description of today's podcast on our homepage at macrovoices.com. So Jeff, let's just do a quick recap here. Gold falling now, even though the fundamentals would appear to be supportive, and a lot of people would think gold should go up in this circumstance. What's going on?
Yeah, and you would think, because not only is it a hedge for sort of the end of the world case, it's also, you know, the opportunity cost of holding gold goes way down when interest rates fall. So it seems like fundamentally this should be very gold positive. And as we're seeing this morning, gold is getting hammered yet again. You know, it's another one of these key 2008 type comparisons. During the 2008 crisis, gold was extremely volatile, and it often fell sharply at the worst possible moments. These are collateral-related symptoms. And, you know, there was one last Thursday, as you pointed out, Eric, March 12th, which was, you know, up and before today. That was the worst day of the crisis so far. If you go to slide 21, you could see the liquidations coming for how gold behaved right off the bat on that particular day. You know, these early morning gold slams that take place while the repo market participants are all squaring their collateral position from the day before. And if they don't have enough collateral because the junk they were using becomes increasingly unusable in the repo market, then unallocated gold is a last resort option. You know, there was an early morning gold slam on the Friday before that too, March 6th, I think it was. You know, it was an almost exact carbon copy. So you have initial downdraft, you know, about maybe 8:30 in the morning, then a second one before 10:30. And, you know, and that told you how things had been set in motion for what would then happen last Monday and then the rest of the week.
At that point, what good is a rate cut to the federal funds target range? To your point, Jeff, an emergency 50 basis point cut coming when it did may have actually made things worse. And I would contend that the huge intervention that occurred on Sunday made things worse.
Yeah, Eric, I think that's absolutely true. And I don't think there's much doubt about that anymore. I mean, you go back to slide 20. What the system wanted, what it had been demanding for weeks, was some currency elasticity, some real elasticity, in this case, collateral as much as anything else. Instead, what did the Fed do? Jay Powell did once again what was routine, what was within the bureaucratic rules that the Fed operates under. They cut rates because that's what they do. They increase the level of bank reserves regardless of whether bank reserves are the problem because that's what they do.
And just when we thought that last Friday's announcement was the big bazooka, the Fed went all out over the weekend. As far as I understand it, Jeff, this is the biggest monetary intervention event in world history. They decided to cut rates all the way to zero and launch $700 billion worth of QE5. And this time they're not playing any games and pretending QE is not really QE. They're calling it quantitative easing. Now, Jeff, we're recording first thing on Monday morning, so we've only got a couple hours worth of seeing the market reaction. But what do you think of this latest move? Is this just more of those same outdated tools that will be as ineffective as the past few weeks of policy measures? Or do you think that these measures, perhaps because they're so blunt and extreme, might be large enough to address this liquidity problem?
Well, you know, it's impossible to predict for sure. At face value, you look at 0% interest rates, you know, $700 billion of quantitative easing, dollar swap lines, which were already in place, by the way. And they really are throwing everything they can at these markets. And yes, the sheer magnitude of these measures could be enough to fool unaware investors into thinking it's being handled. But, you know, taking a step back, you look at how broad this is and you can't help but ask, where is the precision you expect from a quote-unquote science based on complex quantitative models? If the Fed really had a grasp of what was going on, would they need this kind of show of force, this, you know, shock and awe, whatever you want to call it? Would we even gotten to this point? I mean, that's pretty much what we've been talking about this whole episode so far. You know, the opening of futures markets last night suggested financial markets' faith in central bankers is really starting to fade. And that's one of my major points of emphasis. When I say the central bank isn't central, what I really mean by that, it is starting with the fact that it isn't really a bank. It doesn't conduct competent money-based monetary policy. It's primarily expectations-based policy. You know, they've cut rates in the past and you know, it worked in the pre-crisis era, or at least it appeared to work. So, you know, market participants expect that maybe it'll work now, you know, but it's just a government bureaucracy that doesn't actually deal in money. And as I said before, it's just the appearance of money dealing. You know, this is something that else that Walter Batchett had written about before. If you go to slide 22, in particular, you know, he was well aware of the defect in bureaucracies. When he wrote his book, The English Constitution, in 1867, which was 6 years before Lombard Street, he devoted a significant chunk of it to how a bureaucracy becomes a thing unto itself. It gets detached from the real world. They stop caring about results and effective strategies in the name of doing things just because those are the things that it does. A bureaucracy is all about rules and routines. It doesn't matter if it works. It only matters if it gets done. It's only about the procedure. Now, Badgett wasn't writing specifically about central banks in 1867, but he may as well have been. He said it so much better a century and a half ago than I ever could, because the Fed, as a modern bureaucracy, cares only for its routine thinking and nothing about the results of them. They're just repeating the 2008 crisis playbook. And how well did that turn out? You know, markets may or may not believe that this is enough, but for now, it's routine over results, and there's no sign that the Fed will learn their lessons if the crisis deepens, or we see the same problems emerge a few years from now. You know, part of the tragedy of the last dozen years is that central bankers and monetary stewards of the past understood far better the issues that we're dealing with today than the empty suits we're blessed with now. One final quote I'll show you on slide 23. You know, Walter Badgett wrote over 100 years ago, "Men of business in England do not like the currency question. They are perplexed to define accurately what money is. How to count they know, but what to count they do not know." You know, our policymakers still aren't even asking the currency question, let alone answering it. And so we're left to lurch between these stages of this global dollar shortage or euro dollar system decay. Currency inelasticity all throughout the financial system.
Jeff, before we close, I want to ask you to weigh in on some of the feedback that I've gotten from our listeners and other people on financial Twitter, because the way that I've interpreted this weekend's just massive bazooka shot of monetary intervention is I said, holy cow, this is the big moment in financial history. I tweeted out and said, this is a pivotal moment in financial history because the Fed put just expired. They did the biggest intervention ever, and markets went down, not up on it. And the reaction I got from quite a few people, Jeff, was they said, dude, you're missing the point. They're not trying to rescue the stock market. They did this because we face this epic, historic moment in history when all of Western society is facing this coronavirus threat that could shut down the entire economy. What they're doing is exactly the right thing, and they're providing all of this stimulus to keep the economy going. It's not about the market. The market's crashing because there's panic in the system, and that's what markets do. But what my critics are telling me is the Fed's doing exactly the right thing with this intervention in order to support the real economy. Forget about financial markets. Personally, I don't buy that. I think that financial markets and the confidence that financial markets have in central bankers is what's kept this story going for the last 10 years. And I think that a moment of loss of confidence in central banks is a really, really big driver of what's going to happen in the real economy. But I've just described the argument of my critics. What do you think? Am I missing anything?
No, I hear that all the time too. Is it, okay, regardless of what their intent is, are they rescuing the stock market or the economy? How is it stimulus? I mean, people call it stimulus, but yet there's no evidence that it stimulates anything. And so, you know, that gets to the big point where, you know, I think this was the inevitable next step because in a lot of sense, the bond market gave up on central bankers many, many years ago. And the stock market has always been, as you said, under the impression that there is a Fed put. And now all of a sudden, the stock market is joining the bond market on the side of skepticism. And the skepticism is this stuff really stimulus? Is it liquidity? I mean, everybody says it's a flood of liquidity because, I mean, what else would it be? But when you actually, you know, what we've just done for the last, you know, half hour here, as we go through it, there's no evidence that it's actually stimulus or liquidity. And therefore, you know, taking my cues from the bond market, what you're seeing in these curves collapsing is that the markets are saying, wait a minute, you know, yes, the coronavirus is going to be very serious. It's going to maybe, as you pointed out, Eric, it's going to shut down the economy, the global economy for a number of, you know, who knows how long, certainly a significant length of time. But when we look at these curves, it's the long-term impact that's being traded in these things. And that's, to me, what's really important. You know, yes, the coronavirus is going to cause a disruption, but what the markets are saying is that what does the world look like on the other side of it? Do we get back to normal, or is this causing long-term damage? And what the markets are saying is long-term damage. And that's something that the Fed's supposed to be involved with. It's supposed to be effective at stimulating and therefore inoculating the global economy against these long-term consequences. And what the markets are all saying, and now stocks joining the bond market and being skeptical about that, is that this stuff doesn't stimulate anything. And therefore, whatever happens with the coronavirus, it's going to cause damage because there's nothing left to prevent it from doing so.
There have been a huge number of calls, including from people I never would have expected it from, Jeff, people saying what we need to do now is to shut down financial markets for the duration of this coronavirus crisis. And I would have thought, because frankly, I think that's about the stupidest thing that you could do. I would have thought that the powers that be would be smarter than that. But even Steven Mnuchin sort of signaled last week, said he's not ready yet to shut down markets because of coronavirus. So he seemed to be signaling that that might be coming. In my opinion, that's burying the ostrich's head in the sand. Prices are still going down. You're just not discovering them. And you're blinding the owners of assets to their true value, and you're taking away the ability to transact them. To me, it's all a really, really bad story. But what's your perspective? Is there any merit? Number one, is it a good idea? And number two, do you think there's a real risk of it happening? And number three, what would the consequences be, or the unforeseen knock-on effects, if they were to do what I think is a really dumb mistake and shut down financial markets?
Well, if it was a good idea, Eric, first and foremost, then why do they only want to shut the markets down when things are going down? You know, it's like, you know, we hate speculators when prices are falling, but yet nobody says anything about speculators when prices are rising precipitously as they were in the, you know, 6 months between September and February. The idea is markets are markets. You either let them clear imbalances, you let them price out future scenarios, because that's information for us. It tells us about, you know, what we should expect going forward, if for no other reason than what we need to do now. And I'm not talking about strictly individual investors, but also people like the Treasury Secretary. He should be paying attention to markets in terms of telling him really good information about what he should be doing. Jay Powell should be looking at the bond market, especially those long end of the curves, and say, you know, I'm not doing my job here. The market is telling me I'm doing a very bad job. Rather than shutting it down and saying I don't accept the verdict, maybe I should start listening to this thing, because the curves have a much, much better track record in these situations than I do. Markets are information, first and foremost. Yes, there are ways to invest and things like that, but it's a very big data sense of a decentralized system telling you the state of the world and telling you about what many people are expecting the state of the world to be in the future. And right now, that's what we should be worried about. That's what we should be focused on. We should be letting the market give us all the information it possibly can about what is the world going to look like on the other side of the coronavirus, because that's, you know, the virus is going to happen. It's already out there. There's not much we can do about that now. We can, you know, do our best to try to mitigate its negative effects and its spread. But what we're interested in is what happens after the pandemic is over. What is the economy? What does the global system look like at that point? And the only way you're really going to know that is if you let the markets trade and tell you what's going on. And that's the only way we can actually find a situation or find the way to fix and get into a better situation on the other side of it.
Well, Jeff, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. We look forward to getting you back in a few weeks for another update. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast on quant and rules-based investing. Be sure to claim your free copy of their recently updated guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. And if you haven't heard it yet, be sure to check out my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following strategies, which is linked in your research roundup email. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.